All right, welcome to class. Before we dive in on our comments, questions, concerns, other things for me. Yes?
So part of the ray tracing algorithm is like for each pixel and then for each object.
Yep.
So when you're doing the for each object step, how do you, is there kind of an implied depth buffer? Like, because you're comparing each object's like point of intersection with the ray and how far.
Yeah, but I don't need a buffer.
Right, but you're comparing.
I'm keeping the closest intersection, that is true. Okay. But I don't need a buffer because I don't need to store anything except the closest one I found.
Right.
So I don't need a raster of values. So yes, there's a depth comparison, but not a depth buffer. Other questions? Okay. Let's talk about this picture. This is a picture in your reading for today. The little introduction to ray tracing. Could you write a program that made this picture? Are there any pieces of this picture that we ought to talk about how to create? Yeah?
There's like the focus.
Yeah, there's focus. This one's all fuzzy compared to that one. Huh. How do you do that? All right, we'll come to that. Anything else in this picture that we should talk about how you would create? Yeah?
It's kind of like a bloom effect from the light behind it.
Yeah, there's like this, like the light is sort of seems to be bleeding into the rest of it. Yeah?
Reflections.
We talked some about reflections last time, but it's probably worth reiterating that, so yeah.
I don't know if it's any different, but like the reflection of the shadow?
Yeah, the reflection of the shadow, right? So we have, and then we actually, it's hard to see this level of light, but we actually have reflections of the shadow. So it's hard to see, but there's like a dozen pixels right here, which is this ball seeing that ball, seeing that ball's shadow, right? So, so all of that has to be done somehow. So let's try to put these pieces together. Along the way, I'm also going to talk about some very practical oopses that you will probably make. Because, you know, we ought to do that sometime, and we can do it reasonably with this picture. Before we do that, though, I want to zoom in on this picture a little bit. Let's zoom way in. That isn't very smooth. All right, individual pixels, different colors. It's quite noisy looking. And everywhere I look, it's all noisy. And then, like, the fuzzy sphere is like a fuzzy bumpy sphere, okay? And that has to do with the fact that we just aren't super patient, and not for really any other reason. And we'll talk a little bit more about patience and how that works, hopefully a little later. But let's talk about the process we're using to do this. So let's start with reaffirming how reflection works. So, as you think about this scene, right, there is going to be some ray. Let's pretend that our camera was over here, even though it isn't. Okay, let's suppose our camera was over here, and we're shooting some ray into the scene. We find it hits a sphere. The next thing we have to do is decide what color to make that sphere. And so typically this involves shooting multiple additional rays. Now for this spot, almost all of the rays don't matter. There is evidently some bright light source slightly behind the camera in this scene, so that I should shoot some ray out to that light source and say, yep, I can see it. And then the sky is white, and so any other ray I can shoot off of this sphere will bump into the sky, which would generate some light. Okay? But for other places I could shoot this ray, let's suppose it bounced into the side of the sphere over there. No, I'm erasing the scene. Okay, that isn't working as well as I'd hoped. Oh well, I'll stop while I'm not horribly behind. From that scene, right, the reflection ray is going to come sort of towards the camera, and it's probably going to hit the ground over here or something, okay, as it bounces off of that normal. I might also worry about, you know, that some of these points back here can't see the main light, but they're still pretty bright, so where is that getting? And so what we do in general, how do I decide why is this pixel seeing that thing? What's happening is the ray that's coming out of the camera and hitting that pixel is then bouncing off of that pixel. or after that point on the sphere, and into this sphere. And having bumped into this sphere, it then does the whole, let's see what this would have looked like if the camera was right there. Okay, and so we're essentially, every time you hit a shiny anything, we shoot a bounce ray, and we just render that one ray as if that had been the one. Okay, and so we do this for the whole scene. For every spot we hit, and we actually use several of them. We'll shoot some of them towards the light, and some of them will bounce off, and some of them will go in random directions, and we'll shoot several hundred through each pixel. And each of them may give a very different answer. If we happen to shoot a ray off of bouncing off of this pixel, it hits that dark shadow there, that will be almost black. We shoot a different ray, it may be purely white. We average them all together to get the color of the pixel. Okay? So this is the idea of how we do the shine. Question about the shine. Yes?
Because it's not 100% reflective, are we averaging diffuse and spectral?
Yep. Shading? Yep. And we can do that either by approximating diffuse using Lambert's law and the known lights, or we can actually just use the BRDF of diffuse, which is bounce everywhere, and the BRDF of specular, which is bounce in that direction, and average together those rays. And depending on how patient we are, the rays will be more accurate, but Lambert's law will be faster. Yes?
So how do you compose colors, like, to get the color of the reflection of the pink ball on the orange ball?
Yeah, how do you compose colors? So there's a couple of different ways we compose colors. So let's talk a little bit about colors. Okay. What does color mean? For ray tracing, when we're not generally thinking about lights, we're usually thinking about subtractive color, as say absorptive color. And subtractive is probably not the ideal word for it. It's really more multiplicative, okay? So if we have, for example, if our light had 1.0, and our object had 1.0, what should be the resulting reflected color? We've actually talked about this before, but it's been several weeks. Yes?
1.0.
Why 1.0?
Because you do an element-wise multiplication.
Element-wise multiplication. Okay? Now, in general, when we make an object, the diffuse and the specular are different colors. This is actually true. Almost all shiny things we see have white shine. Not everything. There are metals that don't. But for example, all of the shiny plastic chairs and the dull shine on the table and glasses and watches and everything shiny around shines all colors. So you'll notice that the shine spots are white because the lights are white. So typically, we expect, this would be sort of our diffuse of our object, but we expect to have a separate specular. Okay, and often that specular is some grayish or whitish color, right? It may be we bounce everything perfectly, it may be something lower than that, but typically that means we just get the light color. But what do we mean by the light color? Well, this really shouldn't be thought of as the light, this is really the ray. Okay, if that ray happened to go to a light, it's the color of the light, but if that ray happened to go somewhere else, it's the color of whatever that is. So how do I know what color to make this pixel? Well, that pixel is partially diffuse and partially specular. So I compute the diffuse color and the specular color sort of separately and average them, although there are ways of implementing so we do it at the same time. But conceptually, the diffuse color, I figure out how much light is hitting it, what the color of the object is, what the color of the light is, multiply the color of light, color of object, and I get the color of that pixel. For the specular, this has white shine spots, so I expect to have a white or very close to white specular color. So I'm basically just shooting a ray and seeing what color it would get there, wherever it bumps into next in the bounce. And that will give me, and I'll average those together, I'll get the color for that pixel. Question?
So for our particular assignment, you say that for shiny objects, they have a shininess S.
Yep.
And it's not completely clear within the assignment, like what the shininess means.
Is what percentage of the light goes shiny instead of diffuse? Okay. Light can't both bounce like off of a mirror and go diffuse. Any given ray does one or the other, or it gets absorbed.
Okay.
We typically think of the absorbed as being part of the diffuse, a dark diffuse color. So every object can have a shininess between 0 and 1. You can't have more than 1 because you need to bounce more light than comes in. You can't have less than 0 because you need to bounce light that wasn't there, right? So we have only, and then by converse, the diffuse is left over the stuff that didn't bounce. Yes?
Before, when you were just talking about how we do element-wise multiplication,
yeah.
Didn't we also, before we did it, had some factor based on the angle that was coming in and stuff?
Yep. And so that will still be part of the diffuse model's BRDF. But that's actually really saying something about how likely a ray shooting off randomly off the surface is to hit the light. So if we are using Lambert's law to approximate shooting all rays, we will still use Lambert's law with that multiplicative term as usual. If we're just shooting rays, the rays we pick will completely determine how this works. Other questions? Okay, so there's shininess. That actually by itself takes care of reflections of shadows. Okay, so if I happen to think about what does this pixel do, well, the ray that hits that pixel then bounced off of that pixel and hit some spot behind this ball, which then got illuminated. It was on the white, purely diffuse ground, so it shot essentially a light up towards the light source that it was bumped into that ball and realized, oh no, I'm in shadow. I can't see the light. But it also shot some other lights in random into the scene and said, but I can see a lot of white sky, so I'm partially lit, that's why it isn't purely black, right? And so when we shoot our reflection ray or a diffuse ray or our whatever ray off of the thing, we just treat that as if it was a primary ray. Everything we do for that ray is the same as we have done for a ray that was coloring a pixel. We'll end up computing a color for it, and we'll use that, but we'll just, instead of propagating it back to the screen, we'll propagate it back to some other computation to get back to the screen. Question?
So it sounds really complicated, but are we still doing like all of this in just like one pass?
No, we typically do this recursively. So typically what do we actually do? We write a function to do a ray trace that takes in a ray and figures out how much light that ray can see. And along the way, when that ray bumps into a shiny thing, it will shoot out a shiny ray. And it will call the same function recursively, find out the color of the shiny ray.
When I meant one pass, like we are still doing like for each pixel.
Yep, we do this for each pixel, and we usually do it hundreds of times for each pixel, actually.
Okay.
With slightly different starting directions or slightly different random bounces when they hit diffuse objects and so on.
Oh, I see. And then.
Other questions? All right. So I think that leaves the thing we haven't talked about is the fuzzy ball, the depth of field effect. So let's talk about the fuzzy ball. All right, how do you draw a fuzzy ball? This actually comes back to what I was asked at the beginning of class last time, or time ago, I don't remember which one. It was like, why can you focus when you only have one eye? Cameras have the same effect, okay? Cameras actually usually have it bigger because they have much bigger lenses typically than our eyes. So if we think about a camera with a big lens, and then somewhere in the back behind the lens is a thing that receives light. And usually there's some way of moving the lens forward and backward, or several lenses, or something that can change the focal depth. Okay? And so there's some point out here at some depth that will focus in on a tiny little dot. And there's any point that's farther out or closer in will instead not. So if it's too close in, it won't focus enough. It'll give me a region. If it's too far out, it will focus too much, and that will also give me a region as it inverts. And so things that are too far or too close won't all land in one spot. We could try simulating the lens. This is more math than we really want to do. Okay? We have reasonably good understanding about how these things behave. And so the usual approach we will do is we'll actually generate our arrays from a random location. There are other approaches to this, but the basic idea is I say, okay, I have this raster. And I know I want to see what is the color of this pixel. So I'm going to shoot a ray into the scene. Now for depth of field, I'll shoot several rays into the scene. And I'll pick some focal depth. I'll theoretically actually sort of put this raster out in the scene. So maybe my eye is way back here. Maybe this is where I'm looking from into the scene. And this is where the objects that I want to have in focus are sitting. And the objects that I want to have out of focus are either closer or farther. Now, if I generate a ray from my eye, if I generate a ray from my eye to that pixel exactly, then everything will be perfectly in focus. But if I randomize a little bit, sort of that initial spot, they will all focus at that depth, but if it's closer, I'll get fuzz, and if it's farther, I'll get fuzz. And so I can sort of run this lens focusing thing backwards. Or I can simulate, what I'm really doing is I'm simulating all of the different points it could have entered the lens. No matter where it entered the lens, it was going to have, all of those would have focused at my focal depth. And so I'll shoot a ray from a random position on my lens to a point in the scene at that focal depth. And I'll treat that, and we'll do a bunch of those for each spot in my scene. So the bigger my lens is, the more fuzz I can have. The farther things are from that focal depth, the more they'll fuzz. And so that will by itself deal with the fuzz here. Okay? That will fuzz my balls. And if I get the correct distribution of rays across the surface of my lens, it'll do it exactly like a real lens. And I can actually even say, oh, I'm going to simulate a camera that had a hexagonal shutter. And so I can generate my rays in a hexagonal pattern and get the kind of secondary effects we would get with a hexagonal lens, etc. Just by generating my rays instead of all from one spot, from a region of space, representing the lens, and then focusing them in on some location. Yes?
So you place the raster at the area we want to focus
on? I mean, there isn't a physical location of a raster. But if I think about what I'm doing, if I think about generating a ray as having a starting position and the coordinate of a raster, then yes, I think about putting it where the focal depth is.
Okay.
Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
How exactly do we handle? So we shoot multiple rays per pixel and then average them.
Yep.
How do we handle the averaging when some rays hit an object and some rays don't hit any object?
Doesn't matter. They each have some amount of color.
Okay.
Right. I mean that's what we have right here. Some rays hit the yellow ball and some didn't.
Okay.
And in this case, we had white behind it. But if we had had transparent behind it, then we'd have an alpha component. Those would average in just fine.
So we should average it so there is an alpha component.
If you have an alpha background, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually in the homework, this is not a completely irrelevant question. If you decide to do the depth of field, we have an alpha component.
Okay.
Right? And so what do we do there? We just say, hey, right, I shoot some number of rays through a pixel. And if it happened to hit the ball, then I get the ball's color. And if it happened to hit sky, I get the sky's color. And I do that for the whole scene. And we can have the rays focus on some location, and everything farther or closer is fuzzy. Yes?
Using this, is there a way to adjust how deep or shallow the depth of field is?
Yep.
How would you do that?
Depth of field doesn't have, if there is one focal distance for a lens, that's how lenses really work.
Yeah.
But I can change how big my lens is. The bigger it is, the more the depth of field will be, and I can change how far out that is. I can't have a region in the real world. I can't have a region that is perfectly in focus.
But I mean, the changing the.
But when I shoot my rays, I can choose how far out I want them to focus at, right? I generate them across an area. The smaller that area is, the more everything is in focus. Until it's a single point, the whole world is in focus, there's no depth of field. The larger it is, the more fuzz I see. And then I also pick how far out to focus them in on by theoretically picking. One way of thinking that is where I put the raster. Question?
So you just average the pixel values of each of those rays?
Yep. Okay. Now, I suppose you could shoot only one ray per pixel, and that would work too in a very noisy sense, right? The more rays you shoot, the smoother the image will be. Right, so this image, I don't know what I did, I think I did 16 or something. 16 different shots for that. This one they probably did on the order of 200, maybe more. Just looking at how not very noisy it is, but still a little noisy. I've done this too many times. Anyway, but you can play around with it. The more rays you shoot, the more smooth everything will appear. The less you shoot, the grainier it will appear. Other questions about this scene? Okay, I also want to mention one other thing that none of you mentioned, but that we did talk about a little bit before. Why is this shadow darker than this shadow? Ambient occlusion. So it could be a separate ambient occlusion effect pass, but this is probably purely ray traced without ambient occlusion, separate pass. What causes that behavior?
The fact that more of the lights are blocked.
More of the lights are blocked. I only see the shine of one light, but everything else is also bright. Right? So here, all very few directions of rays will reach the sky, which is also glowing a little. And so it's going to be darker than out here, where more of the rays will reach the sky. None of them reach the really bright light source, so it's still in the shadow. But it's not in the deepest part of the shadow because there's other sources of light. Technically, even this ball is emitting light, and this ball, all the things in the around it are emitting some light. So I don't see complete black even there, because the rays that leave that spot still hit something. But many of them, to hit something, hit the ball on the ground and the ball on the ground, and each of those absorbs a little bit of energy until they finally get out into the scene and hit light. They've lost most of their energy and so they're quite dark. Yes?
All this that you just said, though, it's not actually anything new, right? From what we already
No, we already talked about that. I just wanted to reiterate this point.
Okay.
Yep, we did talk about this behavior. Okay, let's look at another scene also from that same article. Anything in this scene that we should talk about how to make? Sorry? The stuff inside the balls. There's actually nothing inside the balls. They're balls of pure glass, but it looks like there is. Why does it look like there's stuff inside the balls?
Refraction.
Okay? So this is like reflection. Reflection bounces off on the outside, refraction bounces off on the inside. And it turns out that if your index of refraction is some, this is, I don't know exactly what this is, probably about 1.4, 1.5, something like that, index of refraction, will cause you to have this sort of, it'll be blown up in the middle, it'll be smaller in the back, everything will be upside down as it bounces out the other side and goes someplace. Yeah?
The like weird shadow shine things?
Yeah, these weird shadow shines all over the ground. What? How on earth do we do that? These are called caustics. I have seen multiple pseudo-formal definitions of caustic, and they don't really agree with each other. So we'll just say they're called caustics. Caustics are where you have the light is caused by some amount of focusing and some amount of shadowing. Okay, so why is this area really bright? Well, partly it's because it can see the light source, which is mostly near the camera, but partly it's because some ball, maybe this one, is sort of focusing light in that direction. When you go back here, right, we see this bright spot in the back. That's almost certainly caused by some ball, maybe this one, focusing light in on that area. Okay. And then here where we get all this sort of lumpiness or this single bright spot and so on, all of those are caused by these different balls and cylinders here all reflecting light. Creating these is really hard. Okay? The first approach you might try is we just do the normal thing. I shoot a light out, I hit something purely diffuse, I shoot rays at random into the universe. The chance that any one of those randomly shot rays will not only hit something glass, but hit something glass in a way that refracted exactly back to the light source is so vanishingly small, we would literally have to shoot thousands, tens of thousands of rays off of each diffuse point before we'd start to get anything that looks like this pattern. So we don't do that. Instead, we shoot rays from the light, and we see where they end up. Now, the problem is they don't end up in the camera. We are no more likely to randomly shoot a ray from the light and hit the camera than we are to randomly shoot a ray from the camera and hit the light. So we shoot a ray from the camera into the scene to create an understanding about where the bright spots will be. We sort of store information. There's different ways of doing this, but one way of doing this is we store information in the scene that says, when you hit here, the important place to shoot light is this way. And then we do a second pass that comes into the scene and looks for it. Or we could say, we'll shoot light into the scene until we hit something diffuse, and then we use Lambert's law to shoot it back to the eye. Because remember, everything about light is bidirectional, the B of BRDF, okay? And so, or the BD of BRDF, no, the B of BRDF, sorry. Thinking wrong. Yes, the B of BRDF, bidirectional. So that means all of the laws we would use to say, let's approximate the light's exposure here, we'll also use, let's approximate the camera's exposure. And so we can shoot rays from the light, and then see if they hit the camera. We can shoot rays from the camera, see what they hit. The ones from the camera will give us our refraction. The ones from the light will give us our caustics. And we're good as long as that's all we have to deal with. But when you want to try to deal with complicated scenes, neither of these approaches work beautifully. And I'll actually show an example of that here in a moment. But these are the basic idea of how we do this. Caustics are a lot more expensive. So we will rarely see scenes like this just because they're harder to draw. But sometimes, for an animation, for example, I can render the caustics just once. And so I can spend the time to figure out the caustics. And as the camera moves around, I can just use the forward ray. So there's various optimizations we can make, assuming the things that are refracting light are staying put. Or if we had, for example, a swimming pool where the water is causing caustics on the bottom and is always changing, very often we'll just forget about physically correct and we'll just say, it sort of goes like a fractal. And we'll just do that, okay? And so that, or we could really truly try to make it work correctly, and it will work, right? Water swimming pool conveniently only has one surface, practically. And so it's easier to compute than this scene, where this shine might have been caused by a sphere and a cylinder and another sphere. It's unclear to me because I'm not good enough at working that equation backwards. Other questions about this scene? Okay. All right, so now let's talk about this scene. I actually drew this scene this morning. What is this a picture of? It's a monkey. A monkey inside a glass ball. All right, so let's just think a little bit. I didn't run this long enough to get all of the noise out. So for example, like there's a dark patch here that doesn't belong in any way. We'll get to see a little bit how that comes along, because we'll watch this run a little bit. But this has caustics, okay? And this, which is how the light that didn't hit the monkey focused in on that spot from the light source back behind. I can see a reflection of the light source. It's sort of a, I was trying to make something like these lights. So a sort of a long rectangle. You'll notice I have two of them, but one of them stops at the monkey's head. One of those is a reflection off the front of the sphere, and the other one's a reflection off the back of the sphere. Who knew, right? Anyway, you can also see here this total internal refraction on the top of the sphere. You can see the ground, okay? Because glass does complicated things. But all of that we can do with just reflection and refraction. The hard part of this scene, by far the hard part of this scene, is the light on the monkey. Because if you shoot a ray into this scene and you hit some point on the monkey, where does it need to look for the light? Well, you say, I know where the light is. It's over here someplace. We shoot a ray up there and we exit the sphere and we don't hit the light. We say, there must be no light. So how do I know what direction the ray has to go to find the light? Duh. So then I can say, oh, well, we can solve this with caustics. So we shoot rays forward into the scene and see where they hit the monkey. So that will work okay. But if we do just the simple version, we shoot a ray into the ray from the light onto the monkey, and then we say, let's see if it hits the camera. We come out of the sphere and we bounce again, and we don't hit the camera. And so both directions of the simple version won't work really well. And then we get really complicated things like, why is this part of the monkey bright? Well, that is because light entered the sphere, exited the sphere, bounced off the ground, entered the sphere, and hit the monkey. Okay? All of those are doable. That's not a whole lot of bounces, but we need to know where to look. And so, let's just look a little bit about what happens when I run the scene. So here is the original scene. Let's run it. All right, so here it is. It's running along. So far, it's hard to tell there's a monkey. Okay, and now it's gotten to the point where it'll update every 10 seconds. We can see it found this caustic pretty easily. It even noticed, although we can't see it right now because the second pass just happened, it even noticed it's a little dimmer in the middle because there's an obstacle. Here it's found some parts of the monkey, the light tracing has found it. So we're starting to see some parts of the monkey are getting illuminated and it's trying to sort of figure out over time what direction it needs to sample back in. And as it continues, it'll get better and better, but there's some places that by luck we haven't yet seen a ray for. Right? This ridge of the eyebrow should be brightly lit. But it's dark right now, and it's going to stay dark for a while until some ray we shoot either from the camera hits the light or from the light hits the camera, and we figure out, oh, that's how we illuminate that spot. Okay? So it took me about, I'm currently running it without the graphics card, so it'll take longer. At this speed, it would take me about an hour to get the image I just showed you. It would probably take, at this speed, on the order of 10 hours to get rid of this artifact that makes it look like there's something going on here that isn't really happening. Okay? Those, like, these little higher noise areas, that's just because of how the internal system is caching information. And it's a complete artifact. And it will go away eventually. It'll just take a long time to do that. Okay? To make a ray tracer do this, you have to think about a lot of things that yours just isn't going to think about, let's be honest. Okay? You have to think about how to know if none of the simple approaches find light, how to keep going randomly until you find light and then remember that you found light and using that to find the nearby pixels in the future to find light in similar areas. Okay? And so you end up storing a lot of information in the scene about where it found light, what paths got to lights, what paths got to cameras, and then spreading that to nearby objects and perturbing it until they also find the light in the camera so you can figure out what's illuminated. No single part of it is theoretically complicated. It's just storing stuff in places with data structures, but there's just a lot of them. And knowing what the right ones are and not storing stuff you don't need to requires a lot of work. And so there are people that spend their lives building better and better versions of a ray tracer like this. Yes?
So I just want to clarify about like what's happening each time there are like updates.
Yep.
So is it doing like, when I asked earlier about like multiple passes, like is it doing like the whole like one, you know, shooting one ray for every single pixel and then like doing that over and over again? Or what is happening?
Yeah, so I have actually currently set this up. So it's shooting a bunch more pixels. It's shooting a little over several million rays for each update. Okay, but where is it shooting them? I have told it to have a 70% chance of shooting them in areas it thinks it has wrong, and a 30% chance of shooting them at random into the scene. That's the current customization parameters I have here. Okay, so when it notices, I found a path to the light, all the areas near that will suddenly have a wrongness. And so it's going to shoot a lot of rays in that area to try to fix that out. Once those all sort of start to agree, it will say, okay, I think I've got this right. And so we'll always keep this active understanding of where the most wrong areas and the least wrong areas in its guess are. But because it will completely miss them things the first time, I also say, oh, and shoot some at random to find new wrong areas.
So it's not actually iterating like in any kind of deterministic way?
Like nope.
The rows and columns.
It's random all over. Yep. And could we have done this deterministic? Well, I mean, it's deterministic. It's pseudo-random all over. Which is why I knew exactly where it would have a long time to figure out, because I've watched it do this before. Right? Completely deterministic, but pseudo-random. Does it need to be pseudo-random? No, but eyes are good at detecting patterns. So if whatever the pattern it picked was visible, we would notice it. And so it doesn't want a visual pattern, it wants something random, or random looking to the eye, even though deterministic. Yes?
Has it found like Patrick's monkey? Would it be showing background color or black?
So in this case, those are the same thing in the scene. But for each pixel, it will always show the average of the light that all the rays through that pixel have seen. And so if the first pixel I shot through this went to a transparent background, it would probably show me transparent. And once it then hit if it hit a monkey, it would show me a monkey. If it hit an unlit monkey, it would show me an unlit monkey. And when I hit a lighted monkey, it'll show me a lighted monkey, and so on. Transparent actually turns out not to work very well in ray tracing. Because if I were to say this part of the sphere is transparent, it is true that rays through this part of the sphere exit the back of the scene. But if I were then to superimpose it on something else, I wouldn't get refraction. Because it's transparent, but it's not alpha compositable transparent, because there's refraction going on there. And so it's relatively uncommon, if you're dealing with refraction in particular, to have transparency. Although it happens. Other questions? All right. Let's kill that then. Okay, so we have this scene. That covers much of the theoretic how do we do a ray tracer. Let's now talk about why it's harder than it sounds. Well, all right. First off, if you try to pseudocode out the recursive function, you will find it's not that bad. Okay, let's try doing that. Let's start by how it's easier than it sounds. Okay, ray trace. What does ray trace need to know? It needs to know a ray. Give me a ray. And what do I need to do with the ray? I need to say for each object intersect the object and the ray. And then keep the closest. Okay? Great. So you have to write the intersect methods. You have to keep the closest, but that's just, you know, finding the smallest positive number. That shouldn't be too hard. And then I need to decide how to light it. Okay? So then I could use Lambert's law or something, but in general, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, you know, something like, if it's shiny, then I'm going to ray trace the reflection of R across the normal. And if it's glassy, then I'm going to ray trace the refract of R across the normal, and so on, for all of the different things the BRDF could do. If it's diffuse, I might shoot some ray at random. I might just shoot towards the light. Okay. Each of these is going to give me back either hit nothing or a color. Because that's what ray tracing gives me. It gives me the color of a pixel. And so then how do I know what to do with all those? Well, if it's shiny, I know how shiny it is. And so I take some percentage of the shiny color and some percentage of the refractive color and some percent of the diffuse color. I add them together and I return that result. Question?
Wait, you add them together or you average it?
I do a weighted average.
Yeah.
Yes.
So how does the BRDF play into this?
So the BRDF is a component of the BRDF. This is a component of the BRDF. So if I had the full BRDF, instead of saying if shiny, if glassy, I would say pick a random ray from the BRDF. Some number of those, and that would be the whole of this. I wouldn't have a bunch of if statements.
So you would just do like random selection?
Yep, I would say select based on the distribution function the BRDF says exists for this ray direction, this normal.
Is there a standard number of rays that you would do?
As many as you have time for. Literally, you can't wait so long. Most scenes, you will never get to the point where you say, it couldn't get any better. You often get to the point where you say, it's good enough, but that's a subjective judgment call, right? As we saw earlier when we zoomed in on this scene, it looks pretty smooth until you zoom in. And then you're like, wow, how many more times have I had to go to make that look smooth? Many, right? Arguably, if I think two pixels should be the same color and they differ by 10, then I need to shoot 10 times as many rays. Right? No, even more than that. Right? Yeah, that's rough. It's a rough estimate, right? So, and if I can see the difference, I'm probably differing by 30 or 40 here between adjacent pixels, so I probably need to run this 30 or 40 times as long as I did to make that go away. Right? So yeah, how long do you run it? Forever, if you can. All right, so this is the basic structure of a ray tracer. There's some work as you add more features to adding more things here, and getting your intersect to work is a little bit messy, but you know, you can solve that, it's just geometry. So keep trying, eventually you'll get the right code, right? However, there are some extra unexpected weirdnesses that happen, okay? So let's think about one of those extra unexpected weirdnesses. Let's talk about shadows. In the most general case, shadows just naturally fall out of shooting thousands of rays everywhere, but usually we approximate it. So the approximation we usually use for diffuse, it's an incorrect approximation, but a good first approximation. We usually use something like, if we can ray trace a shadow ray and find that it so if this does not intersect, then we use Lambert's law. Else, we use black. Okay, so we shoot a shadow ray. If it doesn't hit anything, we use Lambert's law because we can see the light. Otherwise, we don't. And we talked a little about what a shadow ray is last time. Let's just as a reminder, right? If this is my object, here's its normal. That actually doesn't matter for the shadow ray a great deal. Here is the light. And I hit some object. It doesn't actually matter where I hit it from. The shadow ray is the ray that goes towards the light from where I hit it. So I create this ray. And you say, does it hit anything? It's a little more complicated than that because I really only want to see, does it hit anything before it gets to the light? So if there's something back here, that doesn't create a shadow. So that's a gotcha. What I really mean, does not intersect before the light. Okay. But that's not the one that's going to cause you to pull out your hair. The one that's going to cause you to be really upset is the fact that if you do this correctly, half of the pixels will randomly turn black. Why would that happen? Yeah?
Because of floating points.
Because of floating points.
You'll find intersections with the object you're on.
Yeah, so what do? I'm creating this ray, right? It has an offset and a direction. I find the T, I use that to find this point. Okay, that point I will never find exactly, except in shockingly rare circumstances, because I have rounding. So it will round sort of to a nearest point in the representable grid in floating point numbers. And that has a 50% chance, almost exactly, of being inside the object. And if it's inside the object, and then I shoot a shadow ray, guess what shadows that object? Itself. Oops. So, and this is something that doesn't get fixed generally by shooting more arrays, because floating point is not random, it is a grid. It's a grid of varying resolution to different parts of the scene, but it's a grid. And so if you shoot a bunch of rays into nearby points, they'll probably round to the same part in the grid, and you'll probably all see the same shadow. Okay, so this will tend to stay. So you have to avoid, this is often called self-intersection. It's not a perfectly correct term, because self-intersection in geometry means the object overlaps itself like a clean bottle. But anyway, but this is often what it's called. This is bad. How could we avoid it? Yes.
You could like give every object a tag.
Okay.
If you're reflecting, like if you're shooting a shadow from an object, you ignore intersections that happen with that same object tag.
Okay, so I could not check my own object for the shadow.
You could just shoot the ray through slightly above the surface of the
object. Offset the ray. Start outside. Or?
I was actually just going to say, wouldn't the tag idea not work if the object like actually does come over?
Oh yeah, we'll find why all of these don't work. Yes?
Could you just try multiple of those possible points and then take the max?
Try several points. Okay? Yeah?
Throw away points and inside the
object? Don't hit the inside. Yeah?
Did you check your point like against the radius, like do a distance calculation from the center?
Check if point rounded wrong. And then do what? And then wish it had rounded right. Okay.
Magic.
Yeah. All right. These are all great ideas. Each of them has the potential to fail. I'm not going to show you a magic better way. We're just going to talk about how you try to get around the failures. Okay. So we, in the end, this will actually be solved correctly by most of you that try. And we'll talk about how. But it'll always have these random rare cases where it's broken. Okay. But we can get it to work for all the objects we're likely to do perfectly, and we'll get through how. So let's start with the various offset ideas. So offset, try several points. Check if it was rounded wrong and offset if it was. Okay, all of these basically say, I'm going to shoot the ray in some version of from a different place or ignoring some level of, we could also say, ignore if t is below some value, it's too close. There's various ways of doing this, okay? All of these have a strange problem. Let's try drawing a separate picture for the strange problem. Let's suppose that I have two objects here and I am looking at them from over here. And there's a light up here someplace. I will see, in this approach, I will see all of this is perfectly in shadow, and all of this is perfectly in shadow, and the area in between is brightly illuminated because it's too close to the other object. Now, we can get this to be a very small area, so it's really unusual to see, but it still causes dramatic effects because a dark area, a little bit of light goes a long way. Literally, it bounces off of things and goes a long way, and your eye sees it easily. So even if there's just like one pixel out of a million where two objects hit that you suddenly see it bright, this is going to cause brightly glowing, unfortunate artifacts in the rendering. Okay? And literally glowing, like they're shining at you. It's in a dark area and something is bright, right? So this is a problem. This is always a problem with this approach. Now, there's ways around it. You could just say, we will never have things touch, right? We could combine it with other approaches. We'll talk about that in a moment to make this mostly go away. It works most of the time, most places, but because it, the way it fails is glowy, it has a problem. Okay? So, we could refuse to hit ourselves. Where will that be the wrong thing to do? Glass. That's a good... Oh, I didn't want that color. All right. If I hit a ray and it needs to refract instead of shadow, what is the wrong hitting there? Okay, the wrong hitting, if it's refracting, is hitting itself again and refracting twice or more. Theoretically, that creates an infinite loop. You keep finding the same spot. Anyway, right? So that's a problem that we could have. But I do, I almost always refractive objects should hit themselves. That's what the ray should do. But not always, because sometimes some fool decided to put a monkey inside your ball, right? And then you have to hit that. So you don't know if there's going to be something inside or not, right? And so you can't guarantee, I can't say only look for myself. I can't even say I want don't want to look for myself because that might hit the wrong part of myself. Okay? So saying I don't want to hit myself, that actually works pretty well for shadow and reflection rays for spheres and planes. It doesn't work for all objects. If, for example, we had a torus, which it turns out to be another thing that we can solve the ray intersection with pretty easily, is donuts. Those could intersect themselves, right? We could have a reflection that needs to bounce off of this side and hit the inside over there. And so donuts are a problem, but we aren't asking you to do donuts, and many ray tracers don't do donuts, so maybe we can just say, nope, if we only have spheres and planes and we don't do refraction, not hitting yourself solves the problem. And it does. But if you need refraction or you need donuts, it doesn't. Yes?
So the not hitting yourself thing was proposed for shadow rays?
That's correct. And I threw in a new task domain here. For shadow rays, it will. For shadow rays, for convex objects, it will work.
Right, so couldn't we just set off the don't ignore yourself filter for fraction rays?
Well, I have a hit yourself problem here as well, where I hit the same spot twice.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So I still need to worry about it for the refraction. It's a different problem with refraction, but I still need to worry about it. So the don't hit yourself works actually pretty well. And it's the basis of a lot of ones we really use. So most ray tracers have some version of this. Some version of, I know the object from which this ray originated, and I refuse to touch that thing again. But we have one extra little piece. Okay? We also had this don't hit the inside. That also won't work in general, because you may have triangles that you want to see from both sides because they're representing some sort of cloth. You may have, you're on the inside of a bubble. There's various reasons you may want to sometimes hit the inside. But what we can usually do is we can say, even for this case, right? I can say this ray here. What do I know about this ray? Okay, I can say it came from that ball, and it may hit the inside only. Because this ray should have entered the object. And so the only thing it can hit is going out of the object. And if it rounds and hits the outside again, I have a problem. And so, and then when I hit over here, I can say, okay, I still came from that object, but now I can hit the outside only. And it turns out if you store the object you came from and whether you're allowed to hit the inside or outside of that object, this is sufficient to deal with virtually every case. There are still weird cases like clean bottles that have the outside of themselves on the outside of themselves, or the inside of themselves on the outside of themselves and so on. But for almost all geometry, this will solve your problem. So frequently, this is what ray tracers will do. Every ray will store the object that I can't hit on one side. Or if it's coming from the camera, that might not be any object, right? So you may say I can hit everything, or you may say there's some object I can only hit from one side, where I can figure out that side by comparing my ray direction to the normal. And so this can avoid this self-intersection problem for refraction, for reflection, for shadows, for most objects. And all the ones we're likely to see. Other questions about self-intersection? Yes?
What if you had like two glass balls that intersected? Would it be okay for that case?
Yeah, so let's find out. Not because I think the case is hugely important, but because I think the process of thinking about it is important. Okay. Let's just think about some rays that won't have problems first. Or let's just try to pick rays and see if they have problems. Let's start with an easy one. A ray that hits here and goes out, that's fine. Question?
What two intersecting glass balls mean?
Nothing in the physical world.
Okay.
But in the ray trace world, it literally means I just had two balls of glass and I said they overlap. And I can do that because I can do that. I'm actually likely to do that because fluid simulation with droplets all over the place, I'm unlikely to pay enough attention to make sure none of them ever touch each other. And so even if I didn't mean to, it's likely to happen occasionally just because I'm lazy. Okay. So the cases I probably need to worry about are if I have a ray coming in here, hitting this object, hitting that object, and bouncing out over here someplace. Notice here, at each of the four ray intersections, the new ray knows what object it came from and what side it's on. It knows what object it came from and what side it's on. It knows what object it came from and what side it's on. It knows what object it came from and what side it's on. The place that I theoretically could have some trouble is for the strange ray that comes in here and hits that point right there. And I theoretically could get stuck in a loop. I could theoretically hit one object, get rounded in a way that hits the other object, get rounded in a way that hits the first object, get rounded in a way that hits the second object, get rounded in a way that hits the first object. And for this reason, for multiple reasons, we're stopping after some number of rays anyway. We don't want infinite recursion. I can make non-broken scenarios of infinite recursion just by putting two mirrors facing each other and the camera in between. Ta-da, right? So we always will go some amount of time and then just quit and say, it must be black, I've run too long. And so that will solve that case here. So it even works for this case, or works pretty well for this case. Other questions? Okay, so let's come back to our pseudocode. Ray tracing, we have this recursive function that calls intersections, and once it finds an intersection, shoots more rays and uses approximations like shadows and Lambert's law to pick out the illumination. And we have to be a little careful about these new rays, make sure they don't hit ourselves in the wrong way. But with that, we can get most of what we need in ray tracing. It is quite possible, and non-trivial numbers of you will do it if you spend the time to try, you can write a fully functional ray tracer with reflection and refraction in just a few hundred lines of code. Most of you won't, but some of you will, because you'll try. And you certainly can do it. That said, you can't write a very efficient one that quickly. Okay? Making it efficient doesn't just mean storing information on the object about where lights are so we can do things that we just talked about with the monkey. It also means what we talked about very briefly at the end of the last time, the spatial bounding hierarchy. These are essential to efficient ray tracing. You can't do good ray tracing without them. You can do slow ray tracing without them that looks good, I guess, if you waited for years. But it literally, basically takes the log of most run times in ray tracing. So for any non-trivial scene of any modest or above size, and by non-trivial scene I mean like there are more than a dozen objects, as in more than a dozen triangles in it, you're going to want one of these to start taking the log of many different computations involved. So, let's look briefly at the spatial bounding hierarchy article, optimizations. They give an example. It's a really bad example from an algorithm standpoint, but it gets across the idea reasonably well. So let's talk about this example. In this example, we see, okay, there are strange objects that aren't touching each other because it makes the world work better. And we're going to make a hierarchy of boxes. We're going to make a box that includes everything, and then a box inside that includes some stuff, another box includes some stuff, and one of those boxes we make more boxes, and that represents this tree. Okay? What would I do with, so one task is creating this tree, and it's more complicated than this, and we'll talk about why. But let's assume I have the tree. What do I do with the tree? Well, I start ray tracing at the root of the tree. I say, does my ray hit A? If the answer is no, I am done. If the answer is yes, I need to say, does it hit the things inside A? Does it hit B? Does it hit C? And only if it's B do I have to check anything inside B. Only if it's C do I have to check anything inside C. And so, for many cases, if we can bound things down nicely, any given ray will hit a fairly small subset of the branches, and we'll end up having to do only a small number of intersections. Yes?
So it seems like the only hard part is the making the tree part, right?
Making the tree is certainly hard.
Because the inside part is just everything you've done already.
It's everything you've done already, although you don't actually have box intersections, but box intersections turn out to be really easy, because they're aligned with coordinate systems. So finding out if you had an axis-aligned bounding box, an AABB as they're often called, axis-aligned bounding box, is really straightforward. It's easier than planes, it's easier than spheres, okay? So yes, so the hard part is how do I create the right hierarchy? And so there's lots of approaches to creating bounding volume hierarchies, spatial bounding hierarchies, there are different names for these. Notably here at the end, it gives an example. Binary space part, so all of the, almost most of these C alsos are kinds of these trees. And you're welcome to read up on these. Let me just talk about a few of them to start with and some of the challenges that come with making them. You can get a lot of speed up with a pretty bad one. Okay? And a better one will give you even more, but having any at all can dramatically speed up any kind of complicated scene. So let's start with the oct tree. Well, actually, let's start with the hard part first. Let's start with a scene that is hard to make a spatial bounding hierarchy for. Let's suppose I have a scene with two macaroni noodles. I can't make a box that gets only one of them. I can't make a twisted box, I can't make spheres, I can't make anything that gets only one of them. Okay? Now, if these are made out of individual polygons, then I can get boxes that get subsets of polygons. And so in practice, this is not as big a problem as it sounds, but sometimes I have this problem. I would also have this problem if, for example, I have two triangles that intersect, something you're probably all painfully familiar with after the last homework, right? So if I have two intersecting triangles, then I also have a problem, where literally there is no box that includes one triangle, not the other, because they include the same point in space. You have a question?
Could you not just include the object in both boxes?
That is exactly what you do. Okay? So if we have some set of objects, and we decide to divide it into boxes, right? We have the box as everything. If I just decide arbitrarily, I'm going to make my bounding box here, and this is A, and this is B, then most objects are only in one. Let's just use some pointers, right? This one has these objects, but that object overlaps the boundary, and so it's in both. That might mean if a ray hits both boxes, I might check that object for intersection twice. And I could keep a list of objects I've already checked to try to avoid that, or I could just say this happens rarely enough, I don't care. And even the rarely enough I don't care will generally still make things faster for you. Although keeping a list of what the objects you've already checked is not grossly hard. It's still a little bit challenging. So, right, we have this case. We just keep multiple references. Yes?
That list of objects that you've already checked is just for that one ray.
For that one ray.
Yeah.
Yep. Essentially, I keep it inside the intersection function as sort of a local allocation there. Yep. All right, so I can do this. So then the question is, how do I make the bounding hierarchy? Let's start with a one that doesn't require any thought. The simplest one that requires no thought at all is a grid. Okay? I can take the world and I can impose a grid on it. I could literally just do a grid of fixed size boxes, no hierarchy involved, and then use DDA to decide what boxes this ray could intersect. I know you don't want to use DDA again, and this is actually not a greatly efficient way of doing things unless you know all of your objects are the same size. But we can also think about this grid as a hierarchy. So if I impose a double size grid over top of my grid, then I have boxes that contain four boxes. And then those four of them, I can impose another box around them and make boxes of boxes of boxes, right? So then I can have my box, there'll be a box over here. Oh, I made that bigger than I meant to, oh well. That contains boxes of boxes inside of it too. And I guess I have some rectangular boxes, and there's actually no reason I can't have rectangular boxes. They're just as easy to do as anything else, so why not? Let's do it. All right, embrace my mistake, okay? So you can just divide the scene. You can say, what's the smallest and biggest x, smallest and biggest y of the whole scene? Cut that in half, cut each of those halves in half, cut each of those halves in half until I'm done. There is a simple optimization on top of this that makes it dramatically more efficient. And that is related to the octree. We actually want the quad tree instead. And do they have the quad tree listed here? Because it'll be easier to picture in 2D. So here is a quad tree of a bunch of little circles. The idea is I have a box and I chop it into sub-boxes. But then I only chop a box into more boxes if it has something. Okay? So I chop this box into halves, and then I chop this box into halves, and then I chop this box into halves, but this box has nothing in, so I stop. I don't need any further boxes there because there's no objects there. I could also stop before I get down to one object. I could stop once I say, I've only got four objects, I don't need to chop things down anymore, let's just intersect those four objects. Right? So we do some early stopping to not have to check so many boxes. And in general, I don't want one object per box because that doubles the work for intersecting that object. Because I have to check the box and then the object, and that's a waste. So generally, I want to stop once I've gotten down to a box that only contains a few objects. There's various pictures of how this works that you're welcome to look through here in the quad tree. An octree is the same thing, but in three dimensions instead of two. It's just really hard to draw, which is why I did two dimensions. But there's no more complicated work here. I turn a cube into eight cubes if it has stuff. And a usual stopping criteria for this is if it has at least eight, or if it has more than eight things, I might get benefit. If it has less than eight things, I'm not going to get an average of benefit, so I'm going to stop early. Although you can play with that depending on how clustered your objects are in your scene. So you chop it down every time, you just check the objects. You just need to check their minimum, maximum, x, y, and z to know if they're in a cell or not. And you keep doing until you found the boxes that contain things. And so these approaches are very effective at making your program faster. There are more complicated ones. You're welcome to read about the R star tree and so on if you want to. But these are the most common, or the easiest to explain, I should say. Yes?
What if you have some object that's really large that crosses the border of multiple?
Yeah. So what if you have a big object that crosses the border? Let's talk about that a little bit. So let's suppose I'm going to just do this purely in the abstract. Okay. Let's suppose I have some hierarchy of boxes. Okay, and then I have my objects. And I find out that some foolish object here is in all of my boxes. What do I do now? Well, I could leave it there, but I could also move it up. So I could say, you know what? Since this is in both of these leaves, it's just here. And then since it's in both of these leaves, I put it up here. And now I only have it once. I might not be able to only get it once, because maybe it was in D and C, and so it has to stay in both of them because they don't share a common root. But often we can compress things and move them up the tree. If you do this, you want to check the objects at a higher level box before you go into the lower leaves, usually. Because if you bump into them closely enough, it may be closer than any part of this box. And so you want to check this to see if you ever need to check the farther of the two boxes. You might be able to shave yourself a lot of work. Yes?
So say you like we're doing the arc one and you say you have 8 children.
Yep.
Does it only need to be in 2 of the children before you move it up, or you want it to be in all the children?
So this is a heuristic. Okay. I mean, you can move everything to the root and not be wrong, just slow.
Yeah.
So you can play around with how many things it needs to be in before you move it up. Yeah.
So basically what you were just suggesting before you answered that was like doing this traversal like breadth first rather than depth first?
Sure. Pre-order rather than post-order. Or you want to visit these nodes, the nodes that are objects you typically want to visit before the nodes that have children. That's neither depth first nor breadth first, right? You do actually want to go depth first, and you want to go through the nearest collision. Because if you can find a collision in the nearest box, that likely will rule out entire other boxes. So you want to go depth first, nearest box, checking object children before internode children if you want maximum efficiency. Now, admittedly, again, all of these things, you can make it more and more efficient, but a naive one will give you a lot. Yes?
Say there was an object in D and E and you hadn't, and you hadn't moved it up.
Yeah.
And you're trying to find a collision with it, or an intersection with
it.
And it happens to be an E, like in reality. When you get to...
Oh, no, your tree will always have it in both.
No, it'll have it in both, yeah.
Your tree never has errors, because you're going to create the tree in advance correctly.
When you traverse down to D, and you find that, and then you find that there's no intersection, the object in that portion, you then move back up. And
so, right, the naive approach would come down here, and it would say, okay, I hit this, I didn't find here or in any of these. So it'll come down, it'll check each of these objects, say, nope, I haven't found it. Go check here, check it again. That is wasted work. I could keep track of, I hit this, I've now seen Y. And it says, that's why I already know the answer. And I can do that if I want. The question is it worth the space and bookkeeping? Am I likely to end up storing a lot of data I don't use or saving myself a lot of work? And often it turns out I'm storing a lot of data I don't use. And so it may or may not give you any speed benefit. It depends partly on how efficient your tree was. If your tree is a bad tree or you have a lot of big objects that you haven't rippled up to higher nodes, this can be a quite useful thing to do. Yes?
Are these trees normally automatically generated, or do people actually manually try to optimize the trees?
I have never seen somebody try to build a spatial bounding hierarchy by hand, ever. Now, the fact I haven't seen it doesn't mean they don't do it. In games, it is amazing what people will do to get themselves an extra 10% speed. But they usually don't do ray tracing, so probably not. Yeah, so similar hierarchies. This is not the only time you want to be able to look at a lot of things in a localized way. Bounding hierarchies are used for lots of applications outside of ray tracing. Yes?
How do you keep track of how many objects are actually in a box?
Keep a list of pointers?
Like checking if it's within the bounds or something.
Oh, how do I figure out what boxes it goes in?
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay, yeah. So we have two types of objects. We have triangles and we have spheres. I just need to know what's the minimum and maximum X, Y, and Z for a triangle or a sphere. This is not 100% accurate, but it's this triangles in particular that's put in some boxes they don't belong in. But a simple version is, I say, okay, does this triangle intersect this axis line bounding box? I just want to know, essentially, does it have a point that is inside or not? And that is just checking this axis, right? Is this point far enough over? If you really care, you can do a little bit better work, because if we think about it from above, I could have this triangle that isn't in the box, but is in X and Y. And so you can do a little bit more work in advance, and sometimes that's worth your while. It depends on it's worth your while if you have long, thin things, and not worth your while if you have sort of small, lumpy things, or small, round things, I guess, in general. But there's different ways of doing that. Other questions? Yes? If I just check, does it have a point in X Yes, does it have a point in Y? Yes, it's in.
So why not check Z?
Or I could check Z too, right? Maybe it's completely in Z, right? I have to actually do an intersection algorithm to see if this really fits, which is more work up front. That's probably worth the effort if I'm caring about speed, because I only have to do it once for the scene instead of once per ray. All right, that's what we have. I will see you all on Tuesday.